Thank you, Your Honor. John Ballas on behalf of the defendant Gordon Miller. I'm intending to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal and focus on my arguments going to his conviction rather than sentencing. Starting with my first argument, the evidence here was insufficient for any rational juror to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that Gordon Miller was guilty of the charged methamphetamine offenses. The case centered around the DEA agent's methamphetamine purchases from a co-defendant, Phyllis Mosher, on six dates in 2014 and 2015. Most of the evidence at trial dealt with Mosher's drug deals with the agent and her interactions with co-defendant Donnie Phillips. There was little evidence that Miller was involved in Mosher's drug deals.
Mr. Ballas, because I think we're all familiar with the record. Let me pose what I think I see in this record and have you tell me why you don't think that's enough to on the sufficiency of the evidence. We have at least several transactions between the agent and Mosher where Phillips is plainly involved. For purposes of my discussion now, Mr. Phillips' counsel might dispute that. But Phillips is involved in the agent says, I'd like more. I need more drugs or I need another transaction. And the evidence seems to show on each of those occasions, Mr. Phillips travels someplace, meets with Mr. Miller, returns with the drugs. On those occasions, at least one occasion, Mr. Miller follows Mr. Phillips back to the location where the transaction takes place. And then when arrests are finally made of Mosher and Phillips, Mr. Miller says to his girlfriend, go around and make sure the cops aren't here. Gets in her car. They speed away and they find him they find money in the wheel well and Mosher's phone number or contact information. If I view that evidence in the light most favorable to the government, it's not great, but is it enough to get over their burden?
No, it's not, Your Honor. You know, strong suspicions are not enough. You have to actually have proof beyond a reasonable doubt that a rational juror can conclude. There's two main points I think the court brought up, and I want to address both of them. On the first one, there was one occasion of the six drug deals where Miller and Phillips allegedly met. And that was on February 4th, 2015. Phyllis Mosher had one deal with the agent from lunchtime. And then an officer, Bloxham, testified that he fouled Phillips and ultimately saw Phillips go to the Wild Idol Saloon Byron around 6 p.m. I apologize, but one thing I didn't make a good point of emphasizing in my briefs was that it is clear that the officer testified that Phillips went to three different locations before he went to the Wild Idol Saloon at 6:15 p.m. He mentions this. It is in my brief. Mentions at excerpt of record, page 64, he followed Phillips in a green saloon to different locations and ultimately to the Wild Idol Saloon. What I didn't put in the excerpts of record, and I apologize, is the detail where Mr. Phillips went during that period up until 6 p.m. And I think it's significant. It said reporter's transcript 1017 to 1021. And the officer testifies that Phillips went to three spots. First was addressed at One Los Arboles Court in Richmond. He goes behind a large property with a gate. He goes inside for 2 hours where the officer can't see what he's doing. He then leaves, gets in the car, and he ends up going to the Goodwill store and then also a gas station and then he goes to the Wild Idol Saloon, where one officer testified that he saw Mr. Miller with Mr. Phillips. So I think that's significant, because if from the time of the lunchtime deal to the time later in the evening, the second deal, Mr. Phillips was going to try to get more drugs or making contacts involving drug deal, it was more likely that he did it at this property, One Los Arbos Court, or the other locations, rather than the one with Mr. Miller, where there's no exchange being seen. The officers did not see Mr. Miller give Mr. Phillips anything. And then when they followed him to the at that location, it was at a distance away and at night, and the officers could not see anything exchanged between the men. So because of all that, I don't think that the one observation with Phillips is different. With respect to the second point of Judge Hurwitz at the defendant's arrest, I think it is at least relevant evidence that Mr. Miller saw what he believed were police officers outside, told his girlfriend they went essentially fast from there. But you have to remember that Mr. Miller was a convicted felon. There's a number of people that don't trust police in general. And what it shows is that there's some concern of him, not necessarily that it was the offense charged by the government. And the same thing with respect to the evidence.
Let me just ask you a factual question on that. I think I remember in the record that there's evidence that he had learned about the arrest of Mr. Phillips before he fled. Am I correct in that?
Well, what I remember, what I see in the evidence, and this is at the in the government's excerpts of record.
Yeah, and I've tried to read the whole record in this case. I thought there was the triggering event was learning about the arrests of Mr. Phillips, maybe not Ms. Mosher. Am I wrong?
Well, I know that at supplemental excerpts of record 10 and 11, Mr. Miller learns, I mean, he's texting Mr. Phillips' girlfriend, and he can't find Mr. Phillips, and he's asking her where he is. Can you have him call me? And then he asked for Phyllis's phone number, which shows that he has some friendship with that he knows that Phillips has some friendship with Phyllis Mosher, not necessarily that there was any drug transaction.
Okay. I can go back. I don't want to, we can go back and look at the record on that. Did you want to save the rest of your time for rebuttal, or do you want to?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. Let's hear from counsel for Mr. Phillips.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Alexi Holler appearing on behalf of Mr. Phillips. I would please like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
I'll try to help.
Thank you. This case is about the fundamental right to present a defense during a criminal trial. For Mr. Phillips, there was one potential defense at trial, entrapment. Under the unusual facts presented, the proffered third-party entrapment defense was not precluded by Ninth Circuit law, and it was similar to that recognized by other circuit courts, including the First Circuit and United States versus Luisi. However, under the district court's pretrial ruling, Mr. Phillips was completely barred from pursuing the defense at trial. Without it, the result of the trial was foreordained. Now, it is not unusual for this court to be faced with appeals involving entrapment, where the criminal defendant claims that the evidence was sufficient to justify an entrapment instruction to the jury. But this is not the typical case. Here, Mr. Phillips was denied the right even to present any evidence related to entrapment at trial, both with respect to inducement and lack of predisposition. The entrapment defense was denied before trial as a matter of law. That legal decision by the district court, which is subject to de novo review, violated Mr. Phillips' constitutional rights and warrants reversal. Now, it's important to emphasize that this case does not involve a derivative entrapment theory. In other words, the theory is not that Mr. Phillips was entrapped because Ms. Mosier was entrapped. And a bunch of the cases that are cited by the government and that are in this court's precedent relate to derivative entrapment. And that is not what is at issue here. Instead, the theory here is that Ms. Mosier was an unwitting agent of the government and that she entrapped Mr. Phillips by using improper inducements, including Mr. Phillips's desperate need to help his fund obtain funds for his criminal defense in a then-pending death penalty case. Now, I recognize that this court's decisions in Thixton and Emmert contain broad language that would at first glance appear to preclude a third-party entrapment theory. But these were court decisions, not statutory provisions. The panels decided cases based upon the facts before them, and the facts here are different. And this court has not had the opportunity to address the exception carved out by the First Circuit in Luisi, which was decided in 2007, long after the Ninth Circuit cases. So what is the Luisi exception? Luisi recognized that the defendant raises a valid entrapment defense when he can show, one, a government agent specifically targeted the defendant in order to induce him to commit illegal conduct. Two, the agent acted through the middleman after other government attempts at inducing the defendant had failed. Three, the government agent requested, encouraged, or instructed the middleman to employ a specific inducement, which could be found to be improper. Four, the agent's actions led the middleman to do what the government sought, even if the government did not use improper means of to influence the middleman. And five, as a result of the middleman's inducement, the targeted defendant, in fact, engaged in illegal conduct.
Well, I understand that this was a pretrial ruling, but on the record in this case, all I see is the government agent buying drugs from Ms. Mosier and encouraging her to get more from her supplier. There's no evidence at the outset that he knows who her supplier is there?
There's evidence at ER 373 and 374, the affidavit in support of the criminal complaint. I think a fair reading of that suggests that, number one, or indicates that this agent was aware of Mr. Phillips going all the way back to 2001. This sting operation was an attempt to get Mr. Phillips.
Was he aware? Was there any evidence he was aware that Mr. Phillips was Ms. Mosier's supplier?
Yes, I believe at 373, that is where I would look for that. That basically the CI had told him that Phillips was the supplier. I can pull that up, but
that's okay. Well, I'll find it. Go ahead.
And so, this is what Luisi talks about. I mean, Luisi also involved somebody. Luisi himself was a member of the mafia, of the mob, and it was a targeted operation at Luisi. And here, there was evidence to support that this was a targeted operation at Mr. Phillips. Now, I would agree that the record is not complete on this point, and it doesn't match up with all of the factors set forth in the Luisi case yet. But that's because this defense was denied before trial. Mr. Phillips never got the opportunity to present this defense at trial. He should have received the opportunity to cross-examine the DEA agent about, hey, how did this operation start? Who were you going after? What did you tell exactly Mosier at each of your encounters in terms of Phillips and in terms of targeting Phillips? Did you mention to Ms. Mosier the fact that Mr. Phillips' son was in desperate need of defense funds, for example? There is evidence that this DEA agent was aware that Mr. Phillips' son was facing murder charges. So,
what do you do with our? You think our decision in Emmert has to be overruled also?
I don't actually. I think that Emmert is close, but not. It doesn't fit Luisi. And I think
Emmert is a case in which the government targeted a specific defendant through an unwitting agent, and we said that wasn't entrapment. That's really what you're contending here, isn't it?
But the operation in Emmert focused on Powell. It wasn't. Emmert came in because of Powell. It wasn't an operation that was focused on Emmert at the outset. So So this is a different kind of case in terms of Luisi versus Emmers.
And by the way, I'm not saying that our cases are correctly decided, but we have to assume that for purposes of our three-judge panel.
Right, but I think there is a path here where you would not have to overrule Emmert, because Emmert does not involve the kind of specific targeting that is at issue in Luisi. I would note also that Luisi addressed some of the precedent in the First Circuit that was similar to Thixton, that was similar to Emmert, and distinguished it. And I would point here, for example, in Thixton, this court talked about, well, we don't want to allow third-party entrapment defenses because it would be very hard to prove for the government, because a lot of these interactions would be happening between the private individuals, not with an agent. And Luisi addresses that very concern at page 56 and talks about the fact that in the Luisi-type case, the government is involved at each step of the way. Okay, so this is a driven by the government. And so at page 56 of Luisi, the First Circuit says, you know, that it's not attenuated government involvement. And it distinguished its prior cases, you know, on that basis. So I would urge the court, I mean, I think there's other, you know, scenarios where the government can't get around, for example, search warrant restrictions by using an agent, right? So it, by using even a civilian agent, you know, so this is similar to that. There should be some limits to the government's ability to use agents, witting or unwitting, to entrap a defendant. And all we're saying, all Mr. Phillips is saying, is at least give us the chance. Give us the chance to present the evidence. And if at the end of the day, if at the close of evidence, that evidence is not there to justify an entrapment instruction, or it's not, doesn't satisfy the factors set forth in Luisi, then okay, don't allow it, but at least give us the day in court. I'll give him the chance to present his case. And I see that I've got less than 2 minutes left, so.
Well, we'll save that for rebuttal.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
Let's hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jason Hitt on behalf of the United States. May it please the court. I'm gonna start where defense counsel for Mr. Phillips ended. And I'd like to respond to Judge Hurwitz's question, as well as the argument that specific targeting is somehow improper. And Phillips relies heavily on Luisi, both in his brief and here today. And I think there's important distinctions that are worth noting. The first is, in Luisi, the person in Mosier's position was an individual named Previte, P-R-E-V-I-T-E. And he's readily distinguishable because of three factors. One, he was a paid government informant. Two, he was working at the direction of the FBI to target the defendant, Luisi. And three, the cocaine deal at issue that was charged and went to trial happened because Previte was requesting that the defendant's superior, a man named Merlino, instruct Luisi to do the deal. In contrast, Mosier was never an informant, paid or otherwise, never worked at DEA's direction to do anything, had no authority within a hierarchical organization over Phillips, nor could she order him to do the deals. Moreover, in Luisi, unlike these facts, the undercover agent, a man named McGowan, repeatedly attempted directly to induce Luisi to engage in a cocaine deal. That's sort of entertaining facts because of La Cosa Nostra. But what he was doing was requesting that Luisi trade diamonds for cocaine. And under the facts reported in Luisi, the defendant was kind of uncomfortable with doing the cocaine and was sort of shining on the undercover. So there was direct inducement from the agent into Luisi before getting a paid informant to complete the deal. Here, the undercover agent never dealt directly with Phillips, much less attempted to induce him to do anything. So, and I think it's also worth noting, the agent, while being aware generally because he's a good investigator and had reviewed, you know, evidence and listened to informants, he knew that Phillips was likely one of the suppliers. There's nothing in the record, and nothing came out in trial through all the recordings with Mosier, that he ever induced, counseled, or commanded her to go to Phillips. In fact, a couple of the deals, Mosier went to a completely independent supplier, a woman named Michelle Buster, who's prosecuted separately. And there was no reaction by the agent to say, don't go to her anymore, or stop bringing me that drug. So I think Luisi is just a non-starter. It's readily distinguishable. And it's also worth noting that under, as Judge Hurwitz pointed out, Thixton and Emmert would have to be overruled because the case law that this court has found, which I think is distinguishable from Luisi, on its face, says unequivocally inducement must be provided by someone acting for the government. And there's just simply no evidence that Mosier ever worked for the government. So I think the entrapment is sort of a red herring, and it really doesn't, there's no reason the court could have provided this instruction under the proffered facts at the time of trial. Then I want to turn briefly.
Can I ask you to address with respect to Mr. Miller? I expressed the same concern I did to you, to his counsel. It's the evidence is certainly not overwhelming as to Mr. Miller. Tell me why it's sufficient.
It's sufficient for a number of reasons, Your Honor. First, there were multiple overlapping layers of corroborating evidence that demonstrated that when Mosier needed to get drugs to the UC, particularly on September 11 and February 4th, which the jury convicted him, as well as April 7th, the drugs seized by law enforcement, Mosier, it was a very clear chain of events. Mosier's phone...
As of September 11th, what counts were those?
I believe that's 8 and 9.
Okay, so those were counts on which he was convicted.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and go ahead.
During September 11th deals, it's sort of like, and the way we argued this to the jury was, in that instance, unlike Phillips, the government wasn't looking for Phillips or Miller. Miller came to the government by way of following the data. And the reason the data wasn't available for the earlier deals involving Phillips and Mosier is that we didn't have the records that we did for the September 11th and February 4th deals. In other words, Miller hadn't been figured out yet by the investigation. But by September 11th, they got a break, and they follow Phillips after the second deal, which would be count 9, and he traveled directly out to this very remote property at the base of Mount Diablo. And by following his physical presence, that is Phillips, right after he's received money from Mosier from a drug deal of significance, as well as following Phillips' phone data, it takes you to Miller's property. And it's consistent, that we argued to the jury and the jury found, with Phillips taking money out to Miller for his cut of the deal that Mosier had just done. And then the court touched on the February 4th, where it is very tight, and there is very specific reason that the jury found him guilty on those two counts related to the February 4th deal, and that is what's important is what Mosier is giving unguarded admissions and almost like a real-time update to the undercover that is being corroborated in real-time by physical surveillance and phone records. That is, I have the first part of the delivery that you've ordered. That's the first set of counts, first count on February 4th. But there's a problem, and they have to go get the remaining part. And what the agents see is Phillips going out directly to meet at the Wild Isle Saloon with Miller. An agent walks in at some point and sees them sitting together. But more significantly, Phillips and Miller travel in the same car, meet with an unidentified suspected supplier. Miller is the only person who meets, takes possession of a bag. Phillips then leaves eventually with the bag in his car. And then Mosier, importantly, reports to the UC, hey, they've got the drugs. In other words, the order has been filled. And Mr. Ballas, for the first time, suggests that this earlier stop at the Arbolist property is somehow relevant. If that was true, then it should have gone that Phillips reports to Mosier, I've got the drugs, I'm at Arbolist, I'll bring it over. The drug deal can't happen, the second one on February 4th, until Miller obtains the drugs, gives them to Phillips, and then Phillips is followed directly from the meeting with Miller to Mosier.
Can I ask you, I may be confused here. You were referring to September 11th events?
First, the second, I transitioned to February 4th in my discussion.
Right, no, but when you first referred to September 11th, you said those were counts 8 and 9. I think so. Those were counts 6 and 7 on which Mr. Miller was acquitted. Am I wrong?
I don't think so, but not having it in front of me, Your Honor, this is a fairly massive record, but the evidence on September 11th, whether it was the basis of a conviction or not, it laid the path for the February 4th. It's how the...
Now, I understand that we can consider it even if it was acquitted because it showed contact, for example, over the phone between the two of them, so we know they knew each other.
Well, but also in physical surveillance by Phillips going to Miller's property. I mean, it's two things on September 11th. It isn't just the phone activity and the spike in activity in the phones. It's also that...
Right, but assume for a moment that I'm right, that he was acquitted on those counts. We certainly can't infer from that activity that he was involved in a drug conspiracy on those days, can we?
You can use it to apply the standard under Jackson in the light most favorable that the jury's verdicts on the other counts was supported by the evidence and that every rational inference should be drawn. So maybe the jury got it right. If you're correct and I'm wrong that he was acquitted of those, it doesn't follow that he's not guilty on the remaining counts of the conspiracy, because the other evidence, as the court started to summarize with Mr. Ballas, was significant. And I would say, I don't, to the extent Miller argues it's a close case, then the government wins under the standard of Jackson.
No, I understand. He's not really arguing it's a close case. Be fair. He's arguing that it's not a close case. He wins. I'm saying, to me, at best, it seems like a close case. And so I'm trying to figure out which side of the line it falls on.
Well, I think in addition to the phone activity, the physical surveillance, and the very damaging facts on February 4th, we also have to look at the unguarded admissions to Mosier. She's providing details to the undercover at a time when she can't possibly know she's being recorded. And when you put that evidence together to a jury, there's no way that Mosier can understand that her comment about Phillips's partner being at Hayward would later at trial be corroborated by a record Miller's lawyer put into evidence showing he was in Hayward on the day that Mosier is telling the undercover, right? The confluence of corroborating evidence is what was so powerful in this case. Moreover, you have his very incriminating flight from law enforcement. And Your Honor, Judge Horwitz had asked, did he know when he fled that Phillips had been arrested? And the answer is yes, partly for the reason Mr. Ballas admitted, which is the texts are pretty clear that when Phillips is arrested, Miller is texting with Phillips's girlfriend, and she says, it's all bad. I put a chart in our brief that has the express sort of language. So he knows. More importantly, as reported in Miller's PSR at paragraph 19, when he's arrested after the high-speed chase, he admits to law enforcement, I knew Donnie got arrested earlier today. So there's two grounds.
I know that's in the PSR. Was that introduced at trial?
I think it was, but this was not a contested fact, which the court can take because the district court had no occasion to overrule that uncontested fact in the PSR.
Well, no, that's not right. I mean, we can use that uncontested fact for purposes of sentencing, but the question is whether, with respect to whether the record is sufficient to convict someone, we can only look at what was in the record at trial, correct?
That sounds correct, Your Honor. And if I misstate that was introduced at trial, then I will supplement in a 28J letter. But there was also testimony from Miss Ga, or Miss Gay, depending on how you last name is G-A-A, at trial. That's Miller's girlfriend. And she testified, and I think these facts were very incriminating from the perspective of the jury, that on the day of Phillips's arrest, that he was on his phone a lot, that he had her do what the law enforcement referred to as a heat run. That is, they're in her house in this kind of remote place over by San Jose, and he has her get in the car while he stays at the house and drive around the block to see if she's stopped or arrested. And when she isn't, he then determines, okay, it's clear. And her testimony, if you believe it, was she didn't even know that Miller had hidden the $29,000 in cash under the tire. She was as surprised as law enforcement in finding it. She also said, that wasn't my money. Plus, you have evidence that Miller is aware of who Phyllis is. And the only evidence that would connect those two in this case under this evidence is that she was a downstream distributor from Phillips and Miller. And his concern and his reason to get a hold of Phyllis is to find out, am I in trouble too? Did they get Donnie and are they coming for me? And all of his behavior is consistent with that. And unless the court has specific questions, I think I hit the two main parts. I'm prepared to submit unless you have specific areas you'd like me to emphasize.
Let me ask my colleagues whether they have other questions.
I do not. I have a question about the baseball cap.
Yes, Your Honor.
What was the relevance of the baseball cap?
The relevance, Your Honor, was in the government had, well, me, I was trial counsel. I thought there might be an issue of Miller contesting the connection to the property at Mount Diablo in Contra Costa County, because he's arrested fairly an hour or two away from that in the girlfriend's car. And we had evidence that had he contested that the evidence found at Miller's residence was not his residence, we had evidence of him from his phone and a similar hat found at his house that would link him inextricably to that house. And I think specifically we had a cell phone photo of Miller wearing the hat he was arrested in at other times, including at the house. And so ultimately, Miller's lawyers really couldn't contest it because the evidence was pretty tight that that was Miller's residence. There was some other indicia, but that was the sort of affirmative reason in my own mind why we would put it in, was in the event he tried to distance himself from the incriminating cash found at his house, we would have another way of demonstrating, you know, that's Miller's house and here's how. And that hat was going to help link it up.
Were there two hats or one hat?
There was one hat introduced. There were two hats total seized. So, and they were very similar in style. They were kind of flat brimmed baseball hats. The one introduced that Miller challenges was gray in color, if I recall, and it had the letters Oakland across it. The hat at his house, I think, was red with some other logoing, but it was that same flat brim kind of baseball cap. I think the one at the house said Nomads, but that was not introduced.
I don't get how the hat in the car would connect Miller to the house.
Because we had photos of him in the hat, either at the house or at other occasions, and the hats were very similar style. It ultimately, we didn't have
was to make the photo. That. Was the photo of him in the hat that was found in the car, or in the hat that was found in the house?
It was on his cell phone that was seized from his person.
No, what was the photo? What happened to that?
It was Miller wearing the hat, but I can't recall exactly the context of where he was. But that was why we were
thinking that matter. Which hat was in the photo?
The one that was in the car with him, the one that was introduced. We had photos of him wearing the hat that was introduced. I think it was at the house, but that was our thinking. Ultimately, the evidence came in and it wasn't argued or emphasized. It was really Mr. Phillips's lawyer that introduced a sort of whole other narrative about the hat that frankly didn't even occur to us. And we certainly stayed away from any concern once the court made it clear that was an off limits. And it wasn't anything we cared to do anyhow.
Other questions for the government? I did have one question, and it was about the sentence.
Yes, sir.
And I believe it's in Mr. Phillips's case.
Okay.
His lawyer counsel didn't spend time on it. There seems to be a misstatement by the government that he never made an attempt to plead. And the PSR shows that he made unsuccessful attempts to plead. And I'm not suggesting that you should have accepted those attempts. Does that misstatement and bear on whether or not the judge's denial of the acceptance of responsibility adjustment it was correct?
Well, I don't want to quibble with Your Honor, but it isn't a misstatement from the government's perspective, because the attempt to plead guilty to 15 years, it was an impossibility at the time Mr. Phillips wanted to do that, because the prior conviction had been filed by information. So he could only plead open to 20 years. There was no offer that I could give that would allow him 15 years. And I wasn't going to, given that we were literally the first day of trial. And so from my perspective, it's not a misstatement, but even if it was, he didn't. You know, if he pled open, it was 20 years. He wanted 15, but that was sort of an offer that he had made up that didn't exist at the time. I hope that answers your question.
Was that disclosed in the PSR?
Well, I think the probation officer was aware of it because the interaction with
Phillips. No, I know he was aware of it. My question was did the PSR disclose that history?
I'm not sure without looking at it. I know it because it existed, but.
Other questions? Judge Press, did you have one?
I did not, Judge Hurwitz. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. We'll thank the government, and we'll hear from, let's start out with Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Miller's lawyer.
thank you, Your Honor. I have 3 points I'd like to make. First, with respect to the Judge Hurwitz's question about whether Mr. Miller knew that Mr. Phillips had been arrested earlier in the day, I don't believe there's any evidence in the record on that. The government made that assertion at page 26 of its brief, but as counsel noted, that's only listed in the PSR. it was not part of the evidence.
But there is evidence. There is. Am I right that there is evidence that he tried on multiple occasions to get a hold of Mr. Phillips and was unsuccessful? Is that right?
On April 7th, there's text between him and Mr. Phillips' girlfriend. And he says, I can't get a hold of Mr. Phillips. Do you know where he is? Can you have him call me? And then he asks about, do you have Phillips's phone number? It's clear that he knows that Mr. Phillips knows Phillips. And he's asking her because he's concerned about his friend, about how to get in touch with him.
Yeah, now you're making characterizations. I'm just saying, and then what does the girlfriend say in response to when he's asking to find?
Mostly that he's at work and I'll have to get back to you later.
Well, but eventually doesn't she say something like, I can't find him, I'm concerned, or something like that?
Yeah, I think there is something about, she says she doesn't get off until 11. Mr. Miller says, please call me, it's important. He says, as soon as I punch out, I'm about to be off of work. Those are at the text at SER in the government's brief at 10 and 11. And what is in the record was that Agent Nearing said that when Mr. Miller was arrested, he saw officers outside and he asked his girlfriend to drive around to see if she got stopped. The second point I wanted to make was that the court is correct that the prosecutor misspoke, that the counts involving September 11th, Mr. Miller was acquitted on, was the counts 6 and 7. There were no observations of Mr. Miller with Mr. Phillips on that date. And it's also significant that Phillips Mosher references in a recorded conversation that it was her source's girlfriend's birthday that day, September 11th. And Mr. Phillips' girlfriend's birthday was September 11th. So when he's talking with, or when talking with Mr. Phillips on September 11th, it would be reasonable to assume that those conversations may have been involving his girlfriend's birthday. And then finally, with respect to the baseball cap, I think Judge Hurwitz is correct that I misspoke when I talk about it at a close case. I mean that there's no, with respect to the admission of the baseball cap and the evidence of the international travel to Mexico, any error here should require a reversal because the evidence was at a minimum just over sufficient to get the jury to convict. And it may have been because of that baseball hat that references a dangerous motorcycle gang that the jury may have been influenced by other factors to convict. The prosecutor's response was largely about things that weren't in evidence, reasons they thought about introducing the cap, but they didn't need to. Only the one cap was introduced. There was no relevance at all. There was no dispute that Mr. Miller was arrested in the vehicle, that he was there. And under these circumstances, even if the court were to uphold the evidence is sufficient, which I don't believe it is, the court should reverse because of the erroneous admission of the baseball cap and the other evidence.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, please.
Thank you. I would just like to note that the government misreads Luisi in the sense that in Luisi, Previtt, the government informant in that case, is the equivalent of the DEA agent here. Merlino in Luisi is the equivalent of Mosher. Merlino is the unwitting government or unwitting agent in Luisi. And the key issue in Luisi is whether the threat by Merlino, was an improper inducement. So it's just, that's how those cases line up. I just want to make that clear that Merlino is the unwitting agent in Luisi. The other thing I would like to point out is the government says, well, the evidence would not have justified the entrapment instruction. Well, that's because there was no evidence presented at trial. They just didn't allow it. It was
pre-trial. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Did you have any obligation to make a proffer at the time of the pretrial ruling?
Well, there was a proffer made with regard to lack of predisposition.
I understand, but that's a separate issue from what you think the government did wrong. Did you make any proffer pretrial about what evidence you might have about what the government did wrong?
The proffer related to Mosier using an improper inducement related to the son's defense, that was also made by the defense before trial. But the connecting the dots with the DEA agent and Mosier would have really been a matter of testimony. I mean, they couldn't get at that evidence without having Mosier on the stand, without having the agent on the stand to question him about it. And that was just completely precluded by the district court's pretrial ruling.
Well, that's what I was asking. Were you really precluded from asking those questions at trial? Or were you just told that you couldn't present an entrapment defense? I'm not sure those questions would have been irrelevant at trial.
Well, I think the whole defense was shut down. So at that point, I think the record shows that defense counsel, once the defense was shut down, basically most of the trial didn't cross-examine the vast majority of the government's witnesses or did a very pro forma cross-examination because there was no purpose any longer. The defense had been shut down. And I think that, if you look at the Seventh Circuit's decision in Mayfield, that's why I think district court should be really cautious about. I mean, defendants deserve the day in court. The government gets to put on its evidence, and it did here for a very long time. The defense should get to put on its evidence. And if it doesn't justify the instruction, it doesn't justify the instruction. But at least give them that opportunity. That's what the due process clause requires. And it didn't get that here. As to the sentencing issue, I would just like to mention that the government could have dismissed the prior, I believe, to get the deal of 15 years. But more to the point, it showed Mr. Phillips's willingness to plead. And this case is similar to McKinney, where the court said that it was erroneous not to give the acceptance of responsibility reduction in that case. Here, basically, it didn't put on a defense at trial, offered to plead guilty before trial, was very accepted responsibility during the sentencing hearing. Yeah, this is a case that justifies the acceptance of responsibility. You can't just deny it because he went to trial. Yeah, that's improper under this court's precedent.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank all counsel for their arguments and briefing in this interesting case. And this case will be submitted. And that concludes our business for today. We'll be in recess until tomorrow.